This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill. $77.8 trillion, that is the estimate for global government debt. Clearly no small sum by any measure, which begs the question, should we be worried and what implications does it have for policymakers and for the rather fragile economic recovery we are seeing currently? To help us understand this and also share with us an outlook of Malaysia's ratings, we have James McCormack, Global Head of Sovereign Ratings from Fitch Ratings. Thank you for joining us this morning. And like I said, I want to start the conversation with Malaysia because Fitch Ratings did downgrade the sovereign rating of our country to BBB+ from A- whilst maintaining the outlook as stable in early December last year. Now, Fitch, you're the only international rating agency that has done so. But what precipitated that move?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on the show. There's really two rationales behind that rating action. The first and most important really was the government debt level in Malaysia and the trajectory that we had for it going forward. That government debt level we put at around 75% of GDP. And just to give you an idea of a sort of comparison, if we look at other BBB rated sovereigns, which is what Malaysia is now, the median or middle value is around 55% of GDP. So the debt level in Malaysia has always been a little bit high for the rating. It was high in the single A category. It's still a little bit high in the BBB category. So that's one. So generally public finances. The other is what we term governance. And governance can mean a lot of different things to different people. But here we're talking about the issues around political stability or instability. There has been a little interruption, shall we say, in terms of political stability in terms of Malaysia in the last few years. And we use World Bank governance indicators to give us some guidance on those issues. And on those measures, according to the World Bank, Malaysia's governance is a little bit weaker than some of its rating peers. So those are the two factors that drove us.
You know, because the last time Fitch Ratings downgraded Malaysia, it was during the Asian financial crisis of the 1997-1998. And it was only in 2004 when there was an upgrade again. So what would the government have to address for an upgrade of our country's sovereign rating back to A-? And does the recent state of emergency declared push back that timeline even further then?
I don't think the recent state of emergency really changes the dynamics because ratings are really medium term. You know, we're looking at the medium term. We're not looking necessarily at very short term developments like that. So quarterly growth numbers or quarterly performance is not really the focus of what we're up to. If we look back to the Asian financial crisis, it was a different set of issues. It was really across Asia, countries running out of foreign exchange reserves. That's not what we're thinking about now. This is a public finance crisis globally, and Malaysia is no different. Typically, public finance crises actually take longer to resolve than external financing crises. External crises are short and sharp. Public finance pressures tend to be longer. They take political decisions to resolve and then implement. So, you know, it took a while to get back from the last crisis. It's probably going to take a lot of governments, potentially Malaysia, some time to get back from this one as well.
But specifically, is there anything that the government should do to actually get back that A- rating?
Typically, when ratings are upgraded, it's because the debt to GDP ratio is on a downward path. So we can see it in the medium term coming down. It's not necessarily that important about the rate of decline or even the level of the debt, to be honest with you, because we upgrade and downgrade at different levels. It's the direction of change. Can we see a downward path? That's probably one of the most important things in bringing the rating back up.
And to be fair, Malaysia's in good company because Fitch Rating had a record 51 downgrades of, 33 sovereigns in 2020. And this is the part where I find a bit baffling because economists, I mean, most of them tell us that 2021 is going to be a better year, global recovery with vaccine optimism. And even the Fitch House view is a 5.3% annual GDP forecast for 2021. So are the downgrades too late in a way since the worst is over?
You could say that the worst is over from a global macroeconomic perspective because we think that, as you mentioned, we're on the road to recovery in terms of the headline GDP growth numbers. It's a different question as to what's going to happen to global public finances. We think government debt is going to continue to rise. This is not unique to this crisis or even a normal economic cycle. Usually, public finances continue to deteriorate even as economies recover because it takes a while for the revenues to come back. And any spending programs that governments have put in place tend to be withdrawn more slowly than the recovery itself. So globally, we do believe that debt in dollar terms will continue to grow this year, probably begin to stabilize towards the end of the year as a share of GDP. But we still think public finances are, you know, they're not yet improving, but let me put it that way.
So how worried should we be over this global synchronized deterioration in public finances, which according to your report is 94% of the world's GDP?
Well, it is concerning. We've never had debt at that level globally. I think it's something that we see in virtually every region, virtually every country, every rating level. And now, you know, it's one could argue that it's also influencing monetary policy decisions. So the whole macro policy framework is now influenced, we could say, to some degree by these very high levels of government debt. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways you can think about the burden of government debt. The easiest and most intuitive way to think about it is that higher levels of government debt tend to be correlated with weaker GDP growth. So countries that are burdened with high levels of government debt have less resources available for the private sector in terms of investment and lending opportunities. So that's probably the simplest and most intuitive way to think about what a government debt burden brings.
And, the trillion-dollar question is the consequence afterwards, right? Because my issue is about this is that I think most countries never actually really recovered from the 2008 financial crisis. So the public debt level was already high, and now it's even higher. Is it even possible for these governments to unwind from this position?
It is possible, but it's hard. So there's only a couple of ways that government debt to GDP can decline. And it's really the debt to GDP ratio that matters, not so much the nominal dollar figure. It's debt to GDP that we're focused on. Which makes the most sense. So it can go down if there's a big fiscal adjustment. That's typically quite difficult. So government would need to run a surplus and use that surplus to repay the debt. Another way it can come down is if the economy grows faster. So if GDP grows faster than debt, then debt to GDP declines. So that's certainly possible. Another way is if there were inflation. So if inflation moves higher, then typically nominal GDP would also grow faster than the debt burden. Or countries can default or restructure, which is the least appealing option from a financial stability perspective. So there are a couple of ways forward. When we look historically at how government debt to GDP ratios have declined, it's typically been a combination of stronger growth, so stronger economic growth, and some kind of improvement in the fiscal position. And that improvement in the fiscal position requires difficult policy decisions. It requires governments to enact higher taxes and spend less money. And that's not politically popular everywhere. You know, that is hard for politicians to enact. So it's challenging, not impossible, but the higher the debt burden, the bigger the challenge. And now we see that challenge in an awful lot of countries.
And then am I correct to say that this increase in public debt affects emerging markets different from developed markets, right? In what ways? And why is there a difference in how you look at it?
Well, there's quite a big difference in the way that we look at it. It's important to keep in mind that the last 10 years with favorable global financial conditions have really allowed a lot of emerging markets, especially at lower rating levels, to go out and borrow in ways that they had not been able to do before. So this is one of the reasons why we see government debt to GDP going up everywhere. And that run-up in debt in emerging markets has not always been accompanied by a reduction in interest rates. The lower interest rate story that we're all familiar with is really a developed market story. So we know that U.S. policy rates and ECB, European Central Bank policy rates, and Bank of Japan policy rates have been very low. And we also know that 10-year bond yields in those jurisdictions have been on a steady downward decline for as many as 30 or 40 years. That has not been the case in emerging markets. So in developed markets, they can borrow more and actually pay less interest because the interest rate is in decline. Emerging markets have not had that luxury. So when emerging markets borrow more, the interest service burden rises because the interest rates are not in decline. So it is an unequal burden in that developed markets have an advantage of this steady decline in lower interest rates.
And within the emerging market space, right, which particular countries do you see particularly susceptible to debt distress?
Well, if we look at what we saw last year, most of the downgrades and the negative outlooks that we still have in place, Middle East and Africa and Latin America, those are the two regions. These are also the two regions that are sort of driven more by commodities exports than other regions. I suppose the good news is that commodity prices have sort of come back up again. But those two regions in particular have heavier debt burdens and have had their ratings under more pressure, for sure.
But James, if COVID has taught us anything, is that how interrelated economies are on a global scale, right? So is there the possibility of a contagion effect if any of these economies go into distress or there's a default?
Well, we've had a couple of defaults last year. We had a default in Argentina. We had a default in Ecuador, Lebanon, Suriname, and Zambia. So that's more defaults than we've ever had in a single year. So we would expect there's probably going to be a couple of more defaults this year in 2021. But what we did not see last year was contagion. So the typical contagion that we used to worry about in financial markets, in emerging markets in particular, where one country goes bad and its neighboring countries experience something similar, that seems to be less common now. That was really in the early to mid-2000s. But since then, individual countries, one could argue that maybe markets have become more discerning or more sophisticated, however you want to put it. But they don't tar all the countries with the same brush. So contagion seems to be less likely.
And can you be specific in terms of which countries kind of keep you up at night in 2021?
Well, it's many of those that I just mentioned, because the countries that default are typically ones that have just recently defaulted. So,
will new names be added to the list of defaults?
Well, there's a couple of others. Angola is now rated in the CCC range. So, Sri Lanka is a country that faces some pressure. Laos, if we're thinking about countries in Asia. There are a few more that are under pressure. We now have more countries that are rated CCC or lower, which means they're quite close to default in our view, than we do have rated AAA. So that's a first. So there's more countries at the very bottom of the rating scale than the very top.
This morning on The Breakfast Grill, in the hot seat is James McCormack, Global Head of Sovereign Ratings at Fitch Ratings. When we come back, how important is it for governments and policymakers to take heed of the rising levels of sovereign debt? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill, where we're speaking to James McCormack, Global Head of Sovereign Ratings at Fitch Ratings. Before the break, we were talking about Malaysia's sovereign rating and what is needed for an upgrade. Now, James, I think it's been established that, yes, the global government debt level is at all-time high. But are we not in an environment of ultra-low rates? So I'm just wondering, what is the cause of concern at Fitch Ratings? Why does it matter when in most countries, rates are close to or if not already at all-time lows?
Well, the open question there is, can interest rates continue to decline? So if they're at all-time lows and they're close to zero, then we get to the question, can nominal rates go below zero? We don't think that's sustainable as a long-term sort of equilibrium in any country. Long-term rates can stay around zero for long periods of time, as they have in Japan, but that's typically associated with very weak or no growth and very low inflation. So in a normal economic environment, we would not expect interest rates to stay at these very, very low levels. So if interest rates begin to normalize, and it might seem strange to even be talking or thinking about that at this point, especially given the messaging that we've heard from the Fed, the Federal Reserve in the U.S., which has indicated we're nowhere near raising interest rates there. But one would have to assume that in the medium term, interest rates will not remain at these very, very low levels. And then the interest service burden becomes more of a challenge for governments. They may need to look at spending cuts elsewhere because the interest payments are becoming more expensive. And this is something that, if you look at the levels of debt, really could be quite worrying in the medium term, including for countries like the US, where debt to GDP is around 100%. And if you know they do these very long-term projections of interest payments, they become quite substantial as a share of government spending. So that's the worry.
Okay, I'll come back to the US economy. But if we stay on this interest rate topic, right? I mean, if we look at the financial crisis of 2008, after that, we had a decade of ultra low rates. And I think there was some interest rates. Interest rates did creep up, but never close to the pre-financial crisis levels, right? So it appears that going forward, we still need that policy support to boost the global economy, especially in Asia. I think we do see these sporadic waves of infections and this cycle of lockdowns. So I wonder how realistic is it that we can even begin to see interest rates move up at all? I mean, what would be the indicators that we need to pay attention to for that to happen?
Well, the key indicator would be higher inflation, and we don't see that on the horizon in very many jurisdictions. So in the absence of that, I think you're absolutely right that it's premature to be worried about higher interest rates in the short term. We would need to see a fairly robust economic recovery before inflation pressures become more meaningful. So there's either people are unemployed already, or there's what we would call sort of disguised unemployed, where government support programs are keeping them in jobs that may not exist going forward. So there's no upward pressure on wages. Labor markets could be quite loose going forward. So in the short term, I totally take the point that in higher interest rates just does not seem realistic and not a concern, nor does inflation. But I think when those things begin to materialize, that's when we need to start thinking about higher interest rates. And it's good to plan for that now, not then. You want to do your homework first as to thinking about spending adjustments.
And let's come back to the US, right, which is still the world's largest economy. Does a Biden presidency change Fitch's rating outlook, especially considering that Biden has plans to issue a massive stimulus package worth US $1.9 trillion? So for that, wouldn't raising debt be inevitable?
Well, yes, definitely. The debt level in the U.S. is going to continue to go up. There's no question about that. I think the $1.9 trillion, you could think about that as maybe an opening bid in terms of the Biden proposal for the U.S. Congress. We think what will eventually be passed will be something smaller than that, considerably smaller than that, maybe half that size. But that won't be the last fiscal stimulus that we see this year. So this is really only the stimulus program to deal with the virus. You know, the Biden administration has not yet turned to any of its campaign promises, which were around, you know, greater infrastructure spending and things like that. So that and higher taxes, by the way, to pay for it. So that's yet to come. So there's more fiscal developments that we will see probably later in the year. But in the shorter term, absolutely. The fiscal deterioration in the U.S. will be prolonged. As you know, we put the U.S. on negative outlook the middle of last year. We still think that's appropriate. I think what we will be looking to in terms of making a decision on that rating outlook will really be whether or not we believe there's going to be some kind of consolidation strategy afterward. So stimulus right now is perfectly understandable. That makes, you know, that's the sensible thing to do in the face of a virus. What we would like to speak to governments about is what they will do after the virus is over and plans for bringing that back down, sort of under control. And that'll be the focus of our reviews.
And I'm curious, how much patience does Fitch Rating have, actually?
Depends on the debt level. So in some countries, it's more urgent. you know, having at least a strategy is more urgent. I think in the U.S. there is an urgency around this issue just because the debt to GDP ratio has crossed the 100% mark. So, you know, the U.S. is also supported by the fact that it is the issuer of the currency that is the global reserve currency, and it issues the global risk-free asset in terms of U.S. treasuries. There's no indication that either one of those two facts is under pressure. So the dollar is not being displaced. That gives U.S. government an enormous amount of fiscal flexibility. If that were to change, the rating decision would be even quicker.
Dare I ask, what would be the consequence if there was a downgrade?
Well, we wouldn't be the first rating agency to do it. So one of our competitors did it the better part of 10 years ago. So I think in terms of the market reaction, it may be more muted than you think. Obviously, the U.S. is still, you know, the major player in terms of global financial markets, but the market reaction maybe not so, you know, not so large, which is fine. That's not our intention. Our intention is just to differentiate, you know, between the most sound credits and have those at AAA and you know, rank order them below that.
James, in your report entitled Global Perspectives, the Growing Inequality in Global Government Debt Burdens, there was a line there which really interests me, and that is your point that recognition of the fact that there is no free lunch when it comes to debt is something that policymakers should actually take heed of. Do you think they do at all? Because, I mean, Argentina is a classic example of this, right, where there have been multiple defaults in the last 2-3 decades?
Well, I think policymakers in Argentina certainly know there is no free lunch. They've discovered that with these repeated defaults, because the defaults in Argentina are associated with recessions. Argentina has been in recession for the last couple of years. So that's a difficult, very difficult economic environment to operate in. I suppose the no free lunch reference is really for emerging markets. One could argue that for the advanced economies right now, there is a free lunch. Higher debt does not mean higher interest payments. So our view is there's no free lunch in the longer term because we think that interest rates will come back. But even in the short term for emerging markets, there's no free lunch. More debt means less money to spend on other things because the interest payments are higher immediately.
Well, some would say that governments don't take heed of credit agencies in a way is because of the business model that Fitch Rating employs. So, and it's not just Fitch, but of course, it's the likes of your peers, so S&P and Moody's, because credit agencies are meant to provide these global investors with an informed analysis of risk. But at the same time, your services are still paid for by the countries that issue any debt. And the sale of any debt can be made easier and cheaper if the rating is higher. So, James, how do we know that there's independence and Chinese walls as to the ratings that you issue?
Well, post-global financial crisis, it's a regulatory requirement. So the separation between what I do on the analytical side and what my colleagues in the business relationship side, the walls between us we're not even on the same floor in the office here. So we don't sort of commingle in that sense. And from an analytical perspective, we really don't know anything about the commercial relationships that we have with the issuers. So, you know, how much they pay or any of those sort of commercial side of things is if we don't know about it, it can't influence us. So on the analytical side, we are kept at some distance from that side of the relationship. And the issuers now, the governments fully understand all of that as well. So they don't talk to us on the analytical side about any of those issues. Either they leave those conversations for a different set of people at Fitch.
On that note, thank you for your time on The Breakfast Grill this morning. It's James McCormick, Global Head of Sovereign Ratings at Fitch Ratings. I'm Wong Xiaoning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.